You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
In April, a total solar eclipse will occur in Mexico, the United States, and Canada. Those who have witnessed such a phenomenon before know how awesome it really is.
You are seeing something that is rare and beautiful, staggeringly awesome and even emotional. People weep. I got choked up seeing this.
A disappearance of the sun prompts many extreme reactions. Animals, including humans, are known to exhibit unusual behavior.
Of course, today we understand eclipses and how to view them safely. So grab your eclipse glasses. This is Big Picture Science from the SETI Institute, and I'm Seth Shostak.
I'm Molly Bentley. In this episode, how to be totally prepared for totality, eclipses in history, and the globe-trotting adventures of eclipse chasers, plus other news about our natural satellite, such as why are we going back to it more than 50 years after Apollo, and why the moon landing conspiracy theory persists. This episode is When the Moon Hits Your Eye.
There was only one person we wanted to discuss the solar eclipse with because we knew he'd go loony over it. A favorite guest, and we're happy to welcome him back to the show, the bad astronomer himself, Phil Plait.
Hi, I'm Phil Plait. I am known as the bad astronomer because I spent a long time debunking bad astronomy, myths and misconceptions about astronomy. I spent many years working on Hubble and then decided that I wanted to do science communication. So I've written several books, and I have a newsletter, and I write for Scientific American, and you can find my work just all over the place.
Phil and Seth share their tips for viewing the great North American eclipse, discuss ancient eclipse lore and history, and consider whether eclipses are possible elsewhere in the solar system. Then later in the show, we'll hear how animals react when day suddenly turns to night, and why NASA and private companies are returning us to the moon, plus why the idea that we never went in the first place never seems to wane. But first, mark your calendars, if you haven't already, for April 8th, when the total solar eclipse passes over North America. Its arc, which begins in the Pacific Ocean, traces a path across Mexico, across 13 states, including Texas, Ohio, and Maine, and the excitement about it is definitely waxing.
So, Phil, you've seen many eclipses. Will you also be seeing the one on April 8th?
I'm actually not. Makes me mildly sad. I did see the 2017 eclipse in Wyoming, so I have actually seen a total solar eclipse. That was the first one I've ever seen. And while I'm not going to get a chance to see this one, unfortunately, it'll be 85% total or so where I am in Virginia. I am hoping to see some in the future, maybe do some traveling and check them out, because it really is worth it to get out there and see one of these things. It's pretty amazing.
I think that's something that's hard for people who've never seen one to appreciate, the fact that it's something that even people who are not terribly interested in astronomy still find extraordinarily compelling.
Well, first of all, it's awesome. It's just super cool to see a total solar eclipse, when it gets dark in the middle of the day, stars come out. In this eclipse coming up here, we'll be able to see Jupiter and Venus actually pretty easily in the sky with the sun. Maybe Saturn, and there's a comet in the sky right now that might be bright enough to see, probably with binoculars. But also, I suspect, after having seen the one in 2017, that part of it is that it takes a long time for this thing to occur. Now, totality, when the moon completely blocks the sun, that may only last, you know, 4 minutes for this eclipse and 2 minutes for the last one, at least the last one in America. But it takes a couple of hours to build up. And in the last half an hour, finally the sky starts to change. The flavor of the light coming from the sun changes. Shadows get sharper. Insects and birds start to react differently. And I think what happens there is that it builds anticipation so that when the sun is finally blocked by the moon and the sun's atmosphere, its corona is revealed and you see all these amazing sights, I think it's built like an action movie, right? You get to that climax and you're like, yes! And it's just truly one of the most beautiful things you've ever seen. And so I think that's why it has such a remarkable and lasting effect on people.
One thing that struck me in the times that I've gone to see solar eclipses, and I don't know, I've seen maybe a half a dozen of them, is that, it's because the action accelerates, right? In the first half hour, you know, the moon slowly covers half the sun. It takes a half an hour. But to cover the next half, so it's three quarters covered, only takes another 15 minutes. And then it's only 7 minutes for the next, factor of two dousing. So I think that, for me at least, it's this acceleration that is so remarkable about solar eclipses.
That sounds like Zeno's eclipse.
Well, tell us who Zeno was for those who don't live next door to him.
God, I hope you don't live next door to him. He's always shooting arrows at your house. He was a Greek philosopher who talked about if you shoot an arrow in the air, first it has to go halfway to its goal, and then it has to go halfway to that point and halfway to that point. And so how does motion even exist? And the answer is that, 3,000 years ago or whatever, we didn't have the mathematics of infinite series. And you didn't know that if you add a half plus a quarter plus an eighth, et cetera, it actually converges to an actual solution.
Yeah. Zeno's paradox, I think. It's
yes.
Indeed.
One of his three paradoxes, I believe.
Oh.
Don't ask me what the other two are until I can check online. Here, you know, keyboard clicking. Oh, yes. I'm well versed with his other two.
Okay, I think that they're one of the most interesting things you can see in the heavens. Obviously, the night sky has a lot of things that are intriguing, puzzling, and in some cases, astounding. But eclipses are something that you can see without really any optical aids. And I know people who had absolutely no interest in astronomy till they saw a solar eclipse, and suddenly they wanted to see another one.
That's right. I'll add that until totality, you do have to protect your eyes. You are looking at the sun, and you don't want to get what's called solar retinopathy, which is sunlight damage to your retina. It can cause damage to your retina and cause partial blindness. You don't want to fool around with that. There are tons of ways to observe the eclipse. The best way is using what are called eclipse glasses. You can get those online, although you got to be careful. Don't just like order a pair. Your best bet is to go to the American Astronomical Society webpage, aas.org, and they have a page on eclipses and where you can get ISO rated glasses that are safe to use. But other than that, once it's total, you can just look up and see it as long as you have good eyesight. And I'm a little sad I'm not going to get to see it. I've been traveling the country the past couple of months and still to come, giving talks about the eclipse. And what happened was I wound up giving talks right up to the day before the eclipse and not getting invited to the Path of Totality on the day of. And so it logistically, it just became too hard to try to go someplace because what happens here, getting to the eclipse, if you can find a hotel room, which is, I'm telling you, unless you have a time machine, it's a little too late to book a hotel along the totality path. Getting there isn't that hard. You get there a day early or whatever, but everybody leaves at the same time. You have an event that ends at a very specific time. And if you've ever left like a big football game or something like that at the end of the game, you know what it's like. It's a massive traffic jam. And people said, I drove 2 hours to get there and 14 to get back. And I thought, maybe I'll just fly to the next eclipse next year and see one in, some other country. What are you going to do?
Listen, flying is not such a bad idea. Astronomers occasionally will fly to watch the eclipse and make it longer by flying along the path as the moon's shadow kind of, you know, sweeps across the Earth.
That's right. I have several friends who are umbraphiles, as they call themselves, eclipse shadow lovers, what that literally means, eclipse chasers. And that became a popular thing many years ago, to actually get in a plane. And because the moon's shadow is moving across the face of the Earth at roughly the speed of sound, actually, if you get in an airplane and travel along with it at a few hundred kilometers per hour, you're making it last longer. You're catching up with it a little bit. So you can make a four-minute eclipse last for 6 minutes, which is awfully cool. Especially if you're in a plane with big windows and you're sitting on the correct side. Of course, if you buy one on the wrong side of the aisle, you may want to ask for your money back.
Maybe you could just tell us briefly what causes a solar eclipse and what do you see?
Well, the moon is going around the Earth, and by coincidence, the moon and the sun are about the same size in the sky. The sun is 400 times larger than the moon, but 400 times farther away. And those two things cancel out. So the moon and the sun appear to be the same size in the sky. As the moon goes around the Earth once a month, it usually passes, quote-unquote, above or below the sun in the sky because the orbital alignment doesn't quite work out the way to get an eclipse every month. But somewhere on Earth, roughly once or twice a year, things do line up and the moon completely blocks the sun. Now, if the moon were a lot closer to the Earth or the sun were a lot smaller, the moon would be way bigger than the sun and would block much of the activity close to the surface. And if the moon were farther away or the sun bigger, it wouldn't be able to block the sun completely. But because they're about the same size, we can get an eclipse that lasts for a few minutes. And also, if there's any activity on the sun, and by that I mean eruptions of gas that blow off the surface, prominences and things like that, you've probably seen pictures of these towering spires of gas or arcs across the sun, those can be seen. And given that this year we are heading toward the sun's peak of its activity like that, that could make this eclipse in particular very, very exciting.
This is being called the Great North American Eclipse in some of the media. That sounds like hyperbole to me, but is there anything particularly great about it?
Yeah, the last one was called that as well, oddly enough. This one is better for two reasons over the 2017 eclipse, and that is it'll last longer. This one's 4 minutes, not 2 minutes, and you know it's twice as long. You get twice as much eclipse. And also, because the sun is at the peak of its activity right now, and by that I mean its magnetic activity. It has a magnetic cycle where its magnetic field gets stronger and fades away over about 5.5 years. So it's very weak. 5.5 years later, it's very strong. 5.5 years after that, it's weak again. Because we're near the peak, that means lots of sunspots, lots of activity. As the moon crosses the sun, there'll probably be sunspots to see. When it's total, there may be activity around the edge of the moon. We'll see those prominences and other things shooting out from the sun. But the sun's atmosphere, its corona, which you can only see during an eclipse, should have a lot more structure to it. It's affected by the sun's magnetic field very strongly. So there could be a lot of structure in it, loops and filaments and all kinds of interesting things. Whereas 7 years ago, it was a little bit smoother. Still gorgeous, still spectacular. But this time it should be even more gorgeous and spectacular. Gorgeouser and spectacularer.
So people who are in the path of totality, which, Phil, is about how many miles wide? It's not very wide.
Oh, roughly 100 to 150, I'll say kilometers. But I think it's about 100 miles, something like that.
Yeah. Okay. But if you're not, and you can find, by the way, maps of that swath of the Earth's surface where you can see the total eclipse. But if you're not in that path of totality, should you bother turning off the TV and stepping outside?
I think so. A partial eclipse is still really cool because you can't see the moon per se. Because the moon is between the Earth and the sun, its dark half, the unilluminated half, is facing us. So it's completely black. And so in the sky, you just can't see it. But as it passes in front of the sun, it will start to take a bite out of it, and that will grow over time. And where you are, how much you see of that depends on where you are. I'm in Virginia. 85% of the sun will be blocked. That might be enough to notice it's getting a little bit darker out, or at least less bright. But the closer you are to the path, you know, if you're in Eastern Ohio, say, where you might get 90-95%, that'll be really cool. And it's worth taking a look at. You don't need anything special except a proper filter to protect your eyes. So again, do not look at the sun unless you have proper protection. But if you do, yeah, it's pretty cool. And I will, you know, if it's clear here, I will absolutely be outside snapping pictures of it.
You know, this has been so drilled into the American public that it's dangerous to your eyes to look at the sun that most people, at least certainly a lot of people, figure that the real danger is during the eclipse. And so they put on their eclipse glasses only when the totality is set in, and that's completely opposite to what they ought to be doing.
Yeah, it's kind of a tragedy of our education system, or at least the media, however we're getting the word out about this. I mean, during the eclipse, up to the moment of totality, you are still looking at the sun, the single brightest thing most humans ever encounter, and that can damage your eyes. There are absolutely ophthalmological reports. I have read many about damage to the retina caused by radiation from the sun, mostly because of ultraviolet and infrared. The ultraviolet kind of chemically alters your retina. Infrared heats it up and damages it. And so at any point up to totality, you do not want to be looking at the sun without protection. But then you can take your glasses off when the moon is blocking the sun. If you keep them on, you can't see anything. These glasses are really dark. And I've actually heard of schools saying they're going to not do anything. They're going to actually keep the kids late inside. A lot of places, for example, in Central Time, this happens right after school ends, like around 3 o'clock. And they're not going to let the kids out. And I'm thinking, this is terrible. The school should have ordered eclipse glasses and gotten these kids out there. You could be, what bigger event could you have to inspire kids to be interested in the world around them, especially science and astronomy, than an eclipse? And it's safe to observe as long as you take even the most basic of precautions. So it makes me very sad to hear that some schools are doing it. I'm hoping that there are local people there who are willing to set them straight.
You know, eclipses are one of the oldest astronomical phenomena that we find written down somewhere, written by people who had seen eclipses, going back something like 4,000 or 5,000 years, presumably because you don't need a telescope or anything like that to actually see an eclipse. You mentioned that the reason that it works is that the apparent size of the moon in our skies, half a degree across, something like that, is the same as the apparent size of the sun, okay? And, you know, that's just, I guess you would call it luck. I don't know if you've ever done this. I looked around the solar system, as it were, by looking up the diameters of moons and so forth and so on, to see if there was any other place in the solar system where you could see the equivalent of a solar eclipse. And it turned out, as I recall, there really weren't any places. You know, there are a lot of moons in around Jupiter and Saturn, but none of them was the right size to make the equivalent kind of eclipse. We're very fortunate, I suppose.
I've done that math too, I looked it up someplace, or I made a spreadsheet or did something like that, just for some moons. And at one point, it became easier to say, gosh, how big is the sun from say Jupiter, which is 5 times farther out from the sun than the Earth is. So the sun is a fifth the size. So it becomes easier to sort of think, well, you know, a moon at this distance would be this big, and just to get a feel for it. And it just turns out, yeah, I mean, the moons are either too big or too small. The same with Saturn. Maybe there's an asteroid in the main asteroid belt that has a wee little moon that orbits at the right distance. But as far as the big planets go, it doesn't work. Mars has two moons. They're little potato-shaped rock balls that are way too small. And from the surface, in fact, we have images of video from rovers on the surface of Mars that have shown Phobos and Deimos, these two moons, passing in front of the sun, but they're too small. And so you get what's technically called a transit, not an eclipse. It's still really cool, but you don't get to see the sun's corona, its outer atmosphere, because the corona is far too faint. It's about a millionth as bright as the sun. So if even a little tiny speck of the sun is visible, the corona is glared out. But, you know, from here from Earth, it works just right.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars, and let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars.
Up next, the astronomers discuss dramatic moments in eclipse history and why we're blasting off to the moon again, more than 50 years after the Apollo program ended.
It's when the moon hits your eye on Big Picture Science.
From the latest in artificial intelligence to new apps and business upgrades, the tech industry is always changing and growing. So keep up with the Daily Crunch podcast from TechCrunch. With new episodes released nearly every day, the Daily Crunch gives you a brief overview of the biggest tech headlines, and it's all delivered in around 5 minutes or less, so you can easily hear about the latest updates while trying some of those updates for yourself. Listen to the Daily Crunch now, wherever you get your podcasts. That's the Daily Crunch, wherever you get your podcasts.
We continue our conversation with astronomer Phil Plate about the upcoming total solar eclipse and why our lovely satellite has been in the news for other reasons lately.
You'll read frequently, if you're reading anything about eclipses, is that one thing that occurs is that nature goes quiet, that all the critters in your neighborhood shut up because they think it's nighttime. They may go quiet, although the people around you are anything but quiet. Have you ever noticed any change in your surroundings other than the fact that it's getting dark?
Well, I've only seen a total solar eclipse once, and all the other ones I've seen weren't, the sun wasn't blocked enough to actually make the sky darker. And the one I did see was in Wyoming, which is not renowned for its wildlife just hanging out there. There were some birds and things, but to be honest, I wasn't paying attention. I was a little too focused on what was going on in the sky. But I have heard that this is true, and in fact, there are citizen science projects where people of all walks of life, you don't have to be a trained scientist, can actually observe the world around you and report your findings to scientists. There are citizen science projects involved with the eclipse. If you just look up citizen science eclipse, you'll find some. One of them is to observe wildlife around you and see how quiet it gets, how much the temperature drops during the eclipse, does weather change, things like that. There are apps as well that you can put on your phone or your tablet or whatever to observe what's happening. And I kind of wish I were seeing this one for that reason. Since I've seen it once and this one's longer, I feel like I could spend more time paying attention to it instead of just, you know, standing there slack-jawed like some bonehead like I did last time. But maybe next time.
Well, I think most people do that, and I think that's what they should do, actually, is just enjoy it. Because, you know, people say, well, you know, look for the flares coming off the edge of the sun, whatever. Look for this, look for that. I think you ought to just enjoy it. Just look at it, because it's not something that you experience very often, and it's one of the few things that you can see in the sky that takes place in real time. This isn't something that unwinds over the course of months or years. It happens in the course of minutes. Let's talk a little bit about the history of eclipses, because, you know, it goes back quite a ways. According to some NASA website that I read, people were describing solar eclipses like 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. And maybe that's not so surprising because they're easily seen, doesn't require any modern instrumentation and so forth. But any interesting stories from the past about how eclipses may have modified human history?
Eclipses, because as you said, you don't need any special equipment. If one happens, you tend to notice. You know, it's 2 in the afternoon or whatever counting system you're using, 4,000, 5,000 years ago, and suddenly the sun is gone. And that's a big deal. So people paid attention to this, and we have records that are, some of them can be hard to interpret from over 5,000 years ago, but getting a little more recent, even 3,000 years ago, a lot of cultures depended on, you know, the sun, the moon, and the stars. They paid attention to the sky because the seasons, right, can be predicted by observing stars and the sun. So they knew their sky, and if something like this happened, they could predict it. And a lot of these civilizations lasted for a long time, so they were able to see cycles to the eclipses. My favorite story, probably apocryphal, is a pair of Chinese astronomers thousands of years ago had neglected to tell the emperor of an eclipse, and were out drinking, which is the part of the story that makes me think it's real. and neglected to tell the emperor. And then when the eclipse happened, the emperor was caught off guard and everybody was really scared, and that those two astronomers wound up losing their heads. And so that just goes to show you that, A, astronomy is a very dangerous profession, and B, if you should be working, you should be doing it. But again, maybe it's probably apocryphal, but it does play into the idea that these were a big deal, that they ascribed a lot of import to them. There was a lot of rituals that went on with eclipses, to bring the sun back. You'd bang on pots or whatever to make a lot of noise to scare off whatever was eating the sun. And so it's just an interesting thing, and that it did affect a lot of civilizations. But now I love the fact that we can predict them not only so accurately, but like down to the second. And we're getting three-dimensional maps of the moon, and we know it's shaped so well that we can actually predict if there's a mountain or a valley that will block the sun in a specific way, and all this kind of stuff. So we're actually really, really good at this. We have learned a lot over several thousand years.
Well, that's a question in itself. I mean, how did the ancients predict these things? They didn't even have a good model of what the solar system was really all about, let alone the measurements that would allow them to predict something that might happen 5 years from now that was going to last for a few minutes. How did they do that?
To my knowledge, now I'm not an astronomical historian, but to my knowledge, if your civilization is around long enough and is big enough, it encompasses a large enough region of the planet, and many did, you will see enough eclipses to start to notice the pattern of cycles. Just like you don't have to understand that the moon goes around the Earth to see the phases of the moon and say to yourself, gosh, we're going to have a full moon in 2 weeks. You just know this because you've seen it happen over and over and over again. Some things take longer, the seasons or a year, and you can notice these patterns that the sun is getting higher in the sky or getting lower in the sky over time, and you, just write it down. And when observing the skies is literally how you support your civilization. You want to know when to plant your seeds so that your people can eat and not, revolt against the dear leader. You're paying attention to the skies. So that's the kind of thing that they would notice and be able to predict, even if they didn't understand the mechanism of it.
So, Phil, the next person you meet at the local coffee shop there says, look, I heard somewhere that there's going to be a solar eclipse. Should I go out of my way to see it? Should I even go out of my house to see it? How do you phrase your answer?
I always say yes. And there are two parts to this answer. So for the next 20 minutes, no. But there are two parts to this. One is that, yes, there will be a zillion pictures of this. And so what I tell people is, if this is your first eclipse, or even if it's not, don't take pictures. There are going to be pictures of it. Experience it, right? Stand there and watch it. Be a part of it. If you're fiddling with your camera, you're missing part of it. You don't want to do that. And that leads into the second part of this, and that is you are seeing something that is rare and beautiful, staggeringly awesome, and even emotional. People weep. I got choked up seeing this. My wife, who has been married to an astronomer for quite some time and has heard everything and seen everything pretty much, also will say, yes, this was amazing, and something well worth watching, because you are seeing it for yourself. It is very different to watch a football game on TV or to go to the stadium, especially if you are surrounded by people watching an eclipse. You are sharing this experience with them. And even if you are alone, that light is hitting your eyes. You are standing outside experiencing this. You are not looking at it on your phone. And so it is a much bigger and yet still somehow much more personal event if you go out and see it yourself. So find yourself safe glasses and get out there and take a look.
Well, Phil, also in the news these days is the moon. Some American hardware has gone back to the moon, so impressed by being there that it fell over. I can still remember 1969, July 20th, which happened to be my birthday, actually. We're going back to the moon after 5 decades. What did we miss the first time? Why are we going back?
What did we miss was essentially the moon. We sent six missions successfully to land on the moon, Apollo 11 through 17, not 13 though. And they landed and they were there for, I mean, Apollo 11, people think it was there for a long time. It was there for hours and then they turned around and left. And even the later missions were only there for a couple of days and only explored very small regions of the moon. Now, since then, we've had, you know, better telescopes. We've had orbiters snapping away, mapping the surface of the moon. We've learned a lot. But even from orbit, there's only so much you can do. You have to go there, land there, and look around. And we learn so much about the Earth when we study the moon, because the moon and the Earth have a shared history. The moon formed from an impact that blasted material out and formed it, and billions of years ago. But also, it's sort of a gateway to space. It is a solid surface where we can build bases, possibly continue our exploration of space from there. This is looking in the long run. But again, just the scientific knowledge of what's going on there. And part of this is the search for water. There may be water ice frozen. Well, we're almost 100% sure that there is water frozen in the permanently shadowed craters on the south pole of the moon, where the sun never really gets very high above the horizon. And that could be, that's water. That could be used to drink. It could be used to make air. It can be used to make rocket fuel. In fact, you break it down into oxygen and hydrogen, and those recombine very violently and make very good rocket fuel. I like the idea that we're going back, and by we, I mean specifically here the United States, but also China. Russia's been looking at that, although their space exploration is kind of in disarray right now. Many other countries are looking to send probes to the moon. And it's, I don't know if I'd call it a new space race, but I like this idea of us going there to explore, and I like the idea of us going there for scientific exploration as we've done in Antarctica. There's been a huge amount we've learned about Earth and Antarctica. I feel that we can do the same as the moon, and I really wish the space agencies involved were actually better at articulating this, because they are asking for a lot of money, and I think that the citizens of the country, the taxpayers, should understand why it is we're doing it, even if it's only because humanity is a species of exploration, and this is something we do, and something we enjoy, and something we love the mystery of.
In a sense, I'm a little bit disappointed, Phil, because when I was a kid, and I was a kid more or less at the same time that you were a kid, right, there were movies, there were articles in magazines and so forth about our future on the moon. And if anybody had asked me, where do you think we'll be when it comes to space exploration by the year, 2024, I would have said, oh, well, we'll probably have a million people living on the moon. They'll be in these colonies. They'll be, orbiting a spacecraft around the Earth that look like, the way they looked in Collier's magazine, right? That we would really be a space-faring society. But in fact, we're not really. And I don't understand what's gone wrong.
Well, there are books that have been written about this, so I don't think we're going to cover it in a short interview. But, the Apollo ended because of the political will kind of went away. It was built in such a way, in my opinion, it was built as a race. And what happens after a race is won, right? Everybody goes home. So once we got to the moon, we'd done it. We'd won the race. So why keep, rerunning this? And then over the years, the idea of going back is part of the problem. We're going back. We're not going there again for the first time. So you can't generate necessarily that kind of excitement, even in a generation for which this is new once more. But the reality of it, this idea that the moon is a real place and we can go there, and it would be amazing to do that. And just over the years, we just went the wrong direction. But now if we really put our hearts and minds and pocketbooks to it, we can do it again. I think that's a message worth messaging.
At some point, presumably, we really will have settlements on the moon, that we'll have a permanent presence on the moon. I mean, that's still in the cards, is it not?
I think so. And that's certainly what NASA is gearing up for. And I have to say, I think that in many ways, NASA is doing this right. There is a long-term plan of going back to stay, not just to leave footprints and flags, as they say, but to go back and do it in a sustainable fashion. There's rock all over the moon, and it's being mercilessly pounded by the solar wind and ultraviolet light and micrometeorites that grinds it into dust called regolith. And it's not like dust on the Earth. It's not like soil. It's sterile, for one thing. And also, when you look at it through a microscope, it's horrendous. It's a horror show. It's all like volcanic jagged glass and things like that. But if you mix it with water or other things, it turns into something that can be used as a building material, like concrete. And there's been a lot of work on doing that, on building machines that can create shelters out of regolith. So you could, you know, land your materials on the moon, build yourself a dome or something like that, cover it in moon rock to protect yourself from radiation and impacts and things like that. And they're doing it. They're looking to the water ice at the South Pole to be able to mine that for air and water and rocket fuel, because water is really heavy and very difficult to take to the moon. But if it's there, why not use it? Use sunlight or nuclear reactors for power, all of these sort of long-term plans. I'm really happy that NASA is doing this instead of, it's not just pie in the sky like it was in Apollo. This seems to be much more feet on the ground. It just depends on whose ground you're talking about, Earth's or moons.
Coming up, astronomer Phil Plait puts on the other hat he wears, that of debunker of conspiracy theories. Why the one about the moon never wanes. Also, he provides his thoughts about the Pentagon's latest UFO report. After all, it's not an alien subject for him.
More of When the Moon Hits Your Eye on Big Picture Science.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
As well as being a professional astronomer who worked on the Hubble Space Telescope, Phil Plait is, he's the bad astronomer, a title earned from spending much of his career debunking astronomy myths and misinformation. One of his earliest books is the clever and fun read, Bad Astronomy, Misconceptions and Misuses Revealed from Astrology to the Moon Landing Hoax.
And we're going to stay with the moon landing because for all the talk about returning to the moon, there are still those who believe we never went. We'd also like to hear Phil's take about the latest UAP report from the DOD, a 63-page unclassified document about 8 decades of UFO sightings, the most comprehensive yet from the Pentagon, that finds no evidence of alien technology or of aliens having visited Earth.
Phil, you spent a lot of your career addressing conspiracy theories, and as the bad astronomer, not because you're a bad astronomer, you're actually a good astronomer, but one conspiracy that seems to be evergreen is that, well, we never really went to the moon. All those videos you saw were done on a soundstage somewhere in Arizona or something similar. Why is it that people don't want to believe we went to the moon?
Oh, man, if I had the answer to that. This idea that the moon landings were faked has been around since the moon landings were actually done, which they were. Let me stress this, that we did in fact go to the moon and land there and bring astronauts safely home to Earth. Even at the time, there were conspiracies about it, and there was a James Bond movie in a chase scene where they're chased through a movie set, which is showing the moon landings being faked. There's the movie Capricorn 1, which nobody remembers anymore, where NASA faked a landing on Mars based on these ideas. This was always sort of on the fringes. And then in 2001, I think it was, Fox TV came out with a quote-unquote documentary called Conspiracy Theory, Did We Land on the Moon? You know, and if they had just said yes, it would have been a very short show. But instead, they show all sorts of ridiculous and Swiss cheese-like claims, just so many holes in them, about, you know, evidence that we didn't go to the moon. And that really gave this conspiracy theory a punch. It was very popular for a while, and this also happened right when the internet was new, so it was easy to send this information out. And I think it's really died off since then. There's always going to be a small fraction of people who believe in wacky stuff, as amazing as that might sound. You may not realize this, that there are people out there who believe in wacky stuff.
News to me.
Yeah, well, that's fake news to you, I think. I think that a lot of the stuff has died down, and that makes me happy. But they're still out there. People who say we didn't land on the moon. People who say all space travel is fake. I mean, you can say to them, well, what about the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that has taken pictures of the moon? What about, you know, these landers that have gone there? And they'll just say it's fake. And at that point, I'm like, well, I'm done with you. There's clearly no evidence or anything I can do to change your mind. I can talk about this, maybe put up a website about it, write about it in a book and do things like that. Because if somebody is questioning it, I would like for them to be able to get the correct information. You're never going to change a true believer's mind, at least not right away. It takes years to erode away that sort of self-confidence in their own misapprehensions. But as long as the information is out there and people can find it, I'm happy for that.
What fraction of the public do you think doubts that we actually went to the moon? I mean, are we talking about 1%? Are we talking about half of the American populace? What are we talking about?
Well, back in the heyday, the only numbers I know were back in the early 2000s after that show came out, and there were a lot of surveys and things. And one of them said 6% of the population, quote unquote, has doubts about the reality of the moon landing. And if you go and look at those research surveys, 6%, if you ask 1,000 people, are you dead? 6% would say yes. So it's kind of in the statistical uncertainty. So I don't think it's a raging firestorm of people who are going to, swamp the American public with this information. It's just, it's out there. And I think it's got legs because it's a big conspiracy. It's about stuff that people don't understand that well, maybe how Apollo worked and all that. It's got space involved, which is always a big deal. And it's easy to couch your claims. Like, why aren't the shadows parallel? And then the question you really ask is, why should they be? And then, you know, you rephrase it a little bit and suddenly it becomes a little bit easier to figure out what's going on. But you can easily ask these questions in a way that make people scratch their heads and say, I don't know. And then what happens is you get a full-blown conspiracy. But again, the good news is it's not nearly as popular as it was. It's been supplanted by 8 million other conspiracies that are actually doing damage to the public. So I don't fret so much about the moon hoax anymore and worry about these other ones.
What about the people who say, well, look, if we really went to the moon and we've got all this, you know, contractor-made hardware sitting up there on its dusty surface, why don't we just train a big telescope on the moon and make photographs of that hardware and thereby prove that we actually went to the moon?
It's a good question, and there are two answers to this. One is that we have. Hubble has taken pictures of the moon, but even Hubble cannot see the landers, which are small. They're RV-sized, roughly, something like that. They're not that big. It's the size of a shed. And even Hubble can only see objects roughly the size of a football stadium on the moon. That surprises a lot of people because they think we have these close-up pictures of galaxies. And it's like, well, the smallest thing you're seeing in that galaxy is still, you know, several trillion miles across because it's very far away. The moon is very much closer. But even then, you can't see things that small. And we have the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has, in fact, photographed all of the Apollo landing sites. You can see them. So there's that. The flip side of that is that if you didn't believe the thousands of photographs that NASA returned from the moon, why would you believe another NASA mission taking pictures of the moon? And in the end, you know, even at the time, the Soviet Union didn't say later on, the government was sort of teaching that NASA faked it. But at the time, the Soviet Union was accepting the legitimacy of NASA landing on the moon. And they were the reason we went, was to beat them. So if they said it was okay, then I think it's probably true.
Well, Phil, in other extraordinary, if true, stories, have you been following the latest about UAPs, as they're now called, unidentified aerial phenomena? You know, the current incarnation of the UFO stories?
Only as long as it takes me to roll my eyes, yawn, and say next. there's everybody's talking about all of these, you know, Navy footage of unidentified aerial phenomena, all this stuff. And it's like, yeah, this is all old news, folks. A lot of these images have been explained. The video has been explained. It's the strange way the cameras work. It's perspective. They've seen another airplane or a balloon or something like that. And every couple of years, some government insider who has all the information is behind closed doors, has spoken to Congress people, and then you know what happens? Nothing. And it's like, you know what? After the 15th time, you know, you might want to keep your wallet in your pocket and not buy into this stuff, because it people say, what's it going to take for you to accept this? And I'm like, proof! Even, you know what? Evidence, just evidence. I don't want a grainy photo that can be explained by 10 other things. I want an alien. You know, it's the trope. It's the cliche. An alien landing on the White House lawn and producing an alloy that cannot be produced by our current technology. Something like that. That would do it. You're making a hugely extraordinary claim, and you're basing it on a bunch of fuzzy videos. Come on. So yes, I may have an opinion strongly felt about this topic.
Phil, we've just seen another report from the intelligence agencies about what's being seen in our skies. And I think that the people who felt that there was a government cover-up of some sort probably still feel that way. And the people who never thought that that was the case probably feel the same way they did before. Why is it that this is, always in the news?
It does seem that we get a report from the government every year or two, or at least something, you know, released to the media, leaked about an investigation into what we used to call UFOs and are now calling UAPs. I guess it's because the public might be demanding it, or certainly it's because Congress is made up of people. And Americans, we love this stuff. We love UFOs. We love the idea of aliens coming here and doing sneaky things behind our backs. And so I think that might be a part of it. It's certainly a way to get attention. I've seen Congress people having press conferences about this sort of thing, and they have nothing to say. If you paid attention at all over, you know, more than one news cycle, and certainly over maybe 5 or 6 or 10 years, you realize they're saying the same things over and over again. We have this shaky, fuzzy footage. Nobody can explain it, which is never true. There's always people who can explain it. You just go on YouTube, and if you search far enough, you can find people who adequately explain these videos pretty well. But it just keeps popping up, and I think it's just, it may be part of you know, the government theater, which we have to put up with and have with since there has been politics, but also because there's just an appetite for it. People want to hear this stuff, and you know, it makes headlines, and people click on it, so they keep trotting it out.
I have to say, I testified a couple of times to Congress, and one of the questions I inevitably got was, well, what really happened at Roswell? And, you know, and you have to remind yourself that the people you're talking to are not scientists. They're mostly lawyers. And, you know, they're as influenced by the popular media as anybody else.
And their information is 40 years out of date. I think that's also kind of important to know, too. You know, they're picking up whatever tabloid they are at the supermarket that's making all sorts of breathless and ridiculous claims and maybe thinking it's real. So I don't know. It's amazing to me that this stuff is still out there, given how thoroughly, and I mean really thoroughly, it's been debunked, and how it's never anything new. Even this footage isn't anything different. And hey, everybody is carrying a really nice phone, a really nice camera on their phone with the video. The video on my camera is incredibly crisp and good. And so where's the good video of these things? And even now, of course, when you see good video, you think, well, somebody may have faked that. And we've come full circle. It's not the government faking downplaying the reality of UFOs. It's people hoaxing UFOs to make them look real. So I don't know. At this point, I don't know if I believe anything anymore.
Well, that's disappointing to hear. Phil, we've got a lot of equipment out there in space orbiting the Earth even farther away that's, you know, revealing to us aspects of the universe that we could never actually see or measure before. Anything in there that really, you know, kind of excites you? Something from James Webb, for example?
All of it. I get so much news all the time from press releases from universities and companies and NASA and American Astronomical Society. And reading through them is always a joy. But I think of everything, it's exoplanets. I just love hearing about planets orbiting alien stars and how much we can learn about them and how much that tells us about our own solar system and our own planet. Just on their own. I just love it. I cannot get enough of it.
Phil, I understand you have a new book coming out. What's the title? What's the subject?
I wrote a book called Under Alien Skies. The hardcover came out last year, and it's about, the subtitle is A Sightseer's Guide to the Universe, and it's a tour guide of the, or a tour book of the moon, of Mars, of going to Saturn. What would these places be like if you were actually there? So it's not just what you see, but what you experience, what you might hear and feel. What would actually happen if you could be there and surround yourself in these things. You know, I should be clear, there are no actual aliens in my book. It's about alien places, so places that are literally otherworldly. I cover what it's like on the moon and Mars, Saturn. That was my favorite chapter. What's it like to fall into a black hole or to be in a cluster of stars and see a million sunrises every day? So these are all very alien experiences, just no aliens involved.
Yeah. Can you actually stand on Saturn?
You cannot. And I make a point that there's no land to land on. But if you were to visit the system and fly over the rings, and in fact, a balloon in the atmosphere would work very well. And I talk about what it would be like to float in Saturn's atmosphere and look up and see the rings and the moons going around. It was a lot of fun to write. And the paperback comes out in April. So a much cheaper version, less expensive, I should say less expensive version of the book. So hie thee to the nearest bookseller and you'll be able to pick up a copy. Under Alien Skies.
Under Alien Skies. Phil Plait, as always, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you. And I hope that one of these days I'll actually see you in the flesh, as they say.
It's been too long. Thank you, Seth.
Phil Plait, a.k.a. The Bad Astronomer, has written many popular science books and writes for Scientific American and is a professional astronomer who spent many years working on Hubble. His latest book is Under Alien Skies, A Sightseer's Guide to the Universe.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
This show is thanks to the uneclipsed talents of senior producer Gary Niederhoff and assistant producers Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley.
Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit education and research organization that searches for life beyond Earth. I'm the Institute's senior astronomer, Seth Shostak. Also a big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters.
The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science that looks, with eclipse glasses on, at the upcoming event on April 8th is called When the Moon Hits Your Eye.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. Get ready to geek out. The Wired Science Podcast explores all the latest and greatest in science, everything from strange diseases and biological breakthroughs to interesting tech and mysteries in outer space. Listen to Wired Science today wherever you get your podcasts. That's Wired Science wherever you get your podcasts.